Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Sydney, I am so excited.
I am too.
We're so excited.
Yeah. We're not teasing. This isn't
one of our classic bits.
This is true blue excitement.
True blue excitement. We have for you such a treat this episode. It is our very first guest episode.
We have said on Sawbones for this is truth. This is complete truth. Justin and I have talked about if we were going to have a guest, who would we want? I was going to say a guest. If we were going to have a guest, who would we want a guest to be? And we have had the same name that we keep coming up with. If we were going to have a guest, this is who we'd want. And we got her.
It's Mary Roach.
Yay.
And she's on the show. She's got a new book called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It's out the first week of June. You can pre-order it now. But this episode, we are going to be talking to her about that and a lot more, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So
she has a lot of great books out there that if you have never heard of Mary Roach before, you should look her up and buy her books. I have been a fan for a long time.
She's basically the most popular science author like in the world.
Fun science. Like it's fun science, but she makes it interesting. And not just because I'm a doctor. Justin can vouch for this.
No, they're great.
For anybody, any interest. So
we talked to Mary Roach, and we're going to listen to her right now. Well, everybody, this is really exciting for us. We are joined by our first ever Sawbones guest. She is the author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook, Bonk, Packing for Mars, Gulp, and her newest Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War will be released in June of 2016, I believe. Please welcome to the show. I don't, you can't, because you can't applaud. You're listening to podcasts. It's Mary Roach, everybody.
Yay! I'm flapping my face to do this.
There's thunderous applause happening.
Yeah.
I can feel it.
Clap wherever you're at, in the subway or in a taxi. Mary Roach, I don't know, Ms. Roach, Mary, I don't know what would be the most appropriate. I'll just go with Ms. Mary Roach. That sounds
good. Sir, Laird.
Laird.
you know what? I'm a Laird. Somebody once sent me the deed. It was some reader in Scotland. There's this thing where it's like a 1 foot square piece of land.
Oh, so sure. I'm actually
technically, well, I guess lady maybe, but I like Laird. Laird.
Laird is good.
Laird, yeah.
So, in our show, throughout medical history, a lot of times you find scientific advances bumping up against pre-existing knowledge or even superstition. You touch on this in your new book, Grunt, which is about the science behind humans at war. You touch on this like in the you have a chapter pretty much just about diarrhea. Which we were both way into, where you talk about how soldiers, one of the soldiers talks about how he believes that he shouldn't sort of block himself up with Imodium, even though the science seems to indicate that, you know, it may be better to let those things run their course without, with Imodium to actually, you know, lean on that in some cases.
Yeah.
Is this a recurring thing you see in the military where these men and women have sort of like risked their lives and have relied on sort of pre-existing knowledge and what they have known before, sort of a hesitance to adopt like new advances?
Oh, I don't think it's unique to the military. I think you hear everywhere. If you come down with diarrhea, people are like, you got to let your body do its work. It's flushing toxins. It's actually ridding itself. That is so widespread. I mean, not just in the folks that I talked to in the military. And I believed it too. I was like, well, it seems to make intuitive sense. And then come to find out these bacteria and these pathogens, it's not something your body's doing to them. It's something they're doing to your body. They're interfering with your ability to absorb moisture in the colon, which I thought was like, wow, knowledge, science, cool. So I don't know that the military's people in the military are unique in their sticking to these beliefs. So just these things that make intuitive sense are hard to shake. You hear it over and over and over again, like, oh, toxins, your body's flushing toxins. It's like, no, it's not. Actually, it's not.
How did you find that some of these researchers who are doing this work, sort of encouraged adoption of these new ideas? You talk in another section about soldiers being hesitant about taking in new technology, things that require, a lot of electronic sophistication because they're just worried about reliability. How does the military handle that idea of like adoption of this technology?
Yeah, the military is this massive machine, and there can be a product, there can be something, a development, like you're talking about, I think about in the hearing loss and the extreme noise chapter, there's this kind of cool thing called TCAPs, which is tactical communication and protection, and as in protecting the ears. So it's this very cool system where you put on this headset and it amplifies quiet sounds and it blocks loud ones. So it's protecting your ears, and at the same time you can still communicate, because soldiers are like, you know what, I'm not putting on heavy duty hearing protection and foam earplugs in my ears, and then I can't hear what somebody's going like, look out, somebody's shooting at you. Right. So it's this conundrum of how do you save their hearing and also not put them in danger. And so then along comes this technology. First of all, it's expensive, and then it's also within the very cumbersome kind of like machine of, is it in the radio budget or the hearing protection budget? You know, it breaks down into all this sort of tedious bureaucracy, and so the ability to sort of get something pushed through is tough. And then also there's a reluctance, like you said, the people who are out, you know, the boots on the ground, people who are doing the job and carrying this heavy pack, the unit leaders are like, it's going to break down. I got to carry the batteries. I got to haul this thing out. It stopped working. They're very wary of new technology. Yeah, it worked great in the demo when you brought it in to the Pentagon or whatever, but is it going to work in the field, you know, in harsh conditions? And how often does the battery going to have to be changed? And so there's understandably a certain amount of reluctance to adopt a new technology. So,
In medical history, we see military advances sort of trickling down into how we treat civilians. Since the 1960s, I think, Sid, you were telling me the military has played a role in something like
8 different vaccines. And there are a lot of things. We talk a lot about this in things like wilderness medicine and global health, things that we use out in the field, like to stop bleeding, or certainly like tourniquets are an easy example of that, or wound care. These are all things that we in civilian medicine have adopted and has been perfected by the military. And in your book, you talk about Navy Captain Robert A. Phillips adding glucose to rehydration fluids. And that helped absorption. That was a huge breakthrough, and that's something I'm very familiar with in like global health. So, is that something that you saw like a theme of as you were doing this?
Yeah, it comes up over and over. I mean, anything that is helpful in keeping alive someone who's hemorrhaging a large amount of blood, and that, you know, that happens in car crashes. It happens all the time in civilian life, and so there's all kinds of things that the military has had to come up with. I mean, it's because this scenario happens so much, hemorrhaging, bleeding out, as they say, dying of blood loss is the number one combat fatality. So they've gotten to be really good at evaluating tourniquets and coming up, you know, I mean, a lot of times what the military is working hand in hand with a private developer, you know, they're saying, this is what we need. Can you help us? So it's sort of a joint process. It's not that the military necessarily invents everything, but they fund the research, okay. and they you know, they push it and they encourage it, and then it comes out, and then of course it makes its way into civilian trauma care or hospitals or whatever it is. So it's you know, burn care also, a tremendous amount of emergency medical care, not necessarily invented, but funded, encouraged, put into use, tested. A lot of testing goes on to make sure, you know, this is something that's going to work and it's worth spending the money on. So yeah, a lot of good inventions.
We see it in video games too. A lot of military starts and trickles down there, actually, from their work. I host a podcast with a doctor. She's sitting across the table from me. And I would say about once an episode, I have to ask her to back up and define a term or something that she has used that I don't understand, because I'm a layman.
And that's definitely a big part of my job, I think, as a physician, is trying to take complex medical concepts that I've taken a lot of time to understand and make them accessible for my patients, who typically aren't also medical professionals. As you study these topics and you immerse yourself in them and you become sort of an expert on them as well, is it hard for you to then continue to make that so accessible? Because I think your books are very accessible for people, you know, without having any expertise necessarily. How do you do that?
I think I do it by never going all that deep. I mean, you have a medical degree. You have spent years studying this stuff, and you keep up to date. And you know, I haven't. So I'm still really operating at a very beginner's level. So it's not difficult to make that jump. But what does happen? Although there are times when I, you know, even after just two years of mucking around in a topic and absorbing what I can, I start to use words that, you know, words become to seem commonplace that 2 years ago I'd never heard that word. And so I rely on my editor to go, Mary, I don't know what you're talking about here. My editor, she's a poet and a novelist. She's intelligent, but she has no background in science and doesn't really read books about science. So she's a great editor for me. She'll go, Mary, what does this mean? I don't get this. It's very helpful for me to have that set of eyeballs on my work, because every now and then I do kind of find myself using a word that or a term and just thinking, everybody knows that, right?
I understand that completely. Justin keeps me in check a lot.
Yeah.
After a lot of episodes, I have to say,
what really hurts is not the not knowing it. It's her incredulity that I am not familiar. Certainly you're kidding. Certainly you've heard of that. When you boil, this is a book about, as we said, about the military and about fighting war and how to help people do that more safely and more efficiently. But when you boil it down to really base, and even I would say this is even a sort of a crass generalization, but a lot of the advances that you talk about in the book are at their center, how do we keep people safer so they can still continue to kill other people?
I mean, you talk about it. So immersed in keeping this person alive that I don't think it crosses their mind that, I mean, you know, that sort of larger institutional reason for keeping a soldier alive. I don't think they see their job. They see themselves as saving someone's life and keeping this person alive. Sure. For themselves, for their family. I don't get the sense that they view themselves as contributing ultimately to the military goal of keeping as many soldiers in the fight as possible. I just don't, they're very caring, dedicated people. And a lot of them, I have to say, when you work day by day with alongside the aftermath of combat, you're not a fan of war. There are a number of people I spoke to hate war. I mean, because they see this very vivid, graphic, tangible result of mm-hmm. bullets and bombs. And they're not fans of military. It's kind of like, you know, I used to work at the San Francisco Zoological Society at the zoo. And there was this group of activists who were like, set the animals free. And I was at the zoo and I'm like, you know what? I'm not a fan of zoos. I work at the Zoological Society. I don't like animals being penned up. I don't like that. But the solution is not to set them free. They're here. And for better or worse, let's make their lives better and sure. more pleasant and healthier. So people at zoos can both dislike zoos and care deeply about the animals in them and want to make their lives better. It's a similar, I mean, I'm not comparing soldiers with zoo animals. It's not my intent, but it's a similar kind of thing where you don't have to like the reasons that you're having to do the work. You don't to still care about it deeply. So I didn't get a sense that they had that in their minds when they were doing their work, and they're very committed, and they're medical people. They want to keep people alive and make them healthy, you know, and they care a lot about what they do. And I didn't feel like that was a theme that came up in my research. It's something I was aware of just because, you know, you every now and then you come across, you know, references to, you know, keeping soldiers in the game, or that being part of the, you know, the military is funny. It's a huge, it's not a big monolith. It's an organization. It's tons of organizations that all add up to this thing that I don't care for, but there are chunks of people who are involved in it who impress the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. And I really just saw them purely as devoted care providers.
I want to hear so much more about your book, but we have to take a quick break, and we will be right back after we visit the billing department. Let's go.
Hi, it's me, your dream. You know, the one that you forgot about, maybe the one that you came up with late one night and thought, that's it, this is what I meant to do. And then you kind of forgot about me. It hurt my feelings, but I do want you to know all hope is not lost, because this is the moment to start. And I have the perfect way, me and some of the other dreams were talking about it. And we think that you should get started with a website. It's a great way to just get something rolling. And even if you don't know website design, I got a partner for you. It's Squarespace. See, they have all these like great world-class web designers, and they make templates. And then you use these templates to kind of plug and play, you know, drag and drop, whatever chunks of website you want, whatever functionality you want to sell stuff, you want to upload photos, videos, whatever you want to do with the website, Squarespace makes it easy. And with the templates they have, they also look beautiful. They look like a pro made them. And they have a lot of great customer support. They're going to help you every step of the way through. They have this new guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint. It's going to make your website look great. Even if you don't really, really, really know what you're doing, Squarespace will make it look like you do. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
You touched on this. You mentioned in the book talking to people who have done, I mean, like really made astounding sacrifices. I mean, sacrifices that would be unfathomable. I feel pretty good about myself holding the door open for somebody. Like I feel like a real big shot. But where you make a sort of half jokingly, you mentioned the book about writing I think you called a gasping fan letter to a Captain White who is terribly injured. Yeah. But the first thought he had and his main concern was about the fate of his men and you know, women that he was serving with. How did you, as a journalist, or were you able to sort of like keep perspective on the broader picture and the topic you're talking about while you were talking to such like people who had done these astounding things?
Well, it was an eye opener for me in that I've never spent time. I don't have family members or friends who've served in the military. So it was my first real exposure to that reality outside of movies and books and, you know, dramatizations and that sort of thing, which is, even though that can be affecting and moving, it's just not the same as standing and talking to someone who's missing one leg and part of another leg and needs his urethra rebuilt. And tells you, in all honesty, and for no reason for him to lie, that because I said, tell me this story. And the first, you know, he's hit. The first thing he does, he throws on a tourniquet, and then he's trying to get up and see who's hit. Who's hit? Because he's the unit leader. Mm-hmm. He's the commander, and he doesn't know who's been hurt. And that's the kind of thing you kind of, I'm familiar with it as like a parent running into a burning building after a child. You know, that kind of bond. You know, a parent's love for a child and that kind of sacrifice. But your buddies and you, meanwhile, are maimed and still do. I mean, I just how to wrap my mind around that was, mm-hmm. it was a different experience for me. It was very, you know, it was a kind of profound mm-hmm. compared to, you know, I'm usually, you know, I'm Mary Roach. I'm off with the cadavers and the maggots. And so this is something, this is a little heavy. It was heavy for, sure. you know, for me. Just, it was kind of amazing.
You briefly touched on this, but I'm curious what sort of baggage about the idea of war did you sort of bring to this book initially? And I'm curious how that evolved over the course of writing the book.
Well, I live in the Bay Area. I'm kind of your typical Bay Area liberal. And I had a sense of, you know, the military, like I was saying before, it just this sort of monolithic entity. And anytime you spend a couple of years, whether it's NASA or the military or the funeral industry, you begin to see that it's impossible to kind of to sum it up with, there's no military. There's the Navy, there's the Army, there's the Marines, there's the Pentagon, there's the bureaucrats, there's the researchers and the scientists and the medics and all of these, they're all different entities and you can have different feelings about different ones. And so it was a process of sort of coming to see all the shades of gray and rather than this black and white sort of good and evil. So it was that kind of an evolution.
Did you have that kind of, you mentioned that, you know, Mary Roach is usually with the cadavers and the maggots. Did you have that thought as you were writing this, that this might be a little more like politically charged than, or, you know, people might be a little more opinionated about these topics than something that you've written before?
Yes. Yeah. I do have that awareness. I mean, I'm writing about the science and
sure.
explaining things and that's sort of where that's my comfort zone. But anytime you write about the military and war, I think you have to expect people are going to want to make it political or have us, you know, want you to kind of bear down on things in a political way. So yes. Yeah.
One of my favorite things about your books is you use humor to really great effect, and especially in that sense of making things relatable that we talked about earlier. And you certainly do that here. But I was curious if you at any point were a little bit hesitant about that, considering that this is a topic that like people cared so deeply about and are so deeply connected to and have such strong feelings about. If you were worried at all about coming off as like, you know, flip because of the sort of gravity of the central issue.
Yes. Yeah. No, I do worry. I do worry about that. I mean, I tried to keep the humor to, there's a couple of historical chapters, which are, kind of hilarious because it's, you know, it's old. First of all, it's the OSS, the precursor to the CIA and some of the correspondence that went on in developing, for a shark repellent is one chapter and also a sort of a stink bomb. So it kind of lent itself to, I mean, it wasn't combat and no, you know, no one was killed. And,
there's a great section about red underwear and it's
the red underwear. Yeah. So, you know, I kind of compartmentalized the humor. I also tried to poke fun at myself as a total outsider and clueless pogue, as they say in the military. I don't know what's going on around me. There's so much to learn. The culture of military is so foreign to me. It was like me stumbling around in Japan for the first time, kind of saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing. So I tried to use humor and also in the footnotes. There's sometimes things that just are kind of quirky or funny that strike me as too hilarious to leave out, but they're not ever in the main story of people being injured in the line of duty. And sure. So I remember that was my effort. My hope was that I kept the humor in places where it was appropriate. But, you know, I'm again, Mary Roach, and I don't necessarily have the best sense of what's dignified, respectful, appropriate, politically correct. These are not my strengths. So, you know, I'm hoping that, the people I've sent it out, I've sent the book out to most of the people in the book who I've been able to get addresses from and have gotten good feedback. And that's incredibly reassuring and gratifying to me, because those are the readers I care about most at this point, is the people who are in it, that they don't feel made fun of or exploited or disrespected.
I will say I can vouch for the funny footnotes. I was reading the chapter about maggot therapy, and so that's something I'm just interested in general. And I remember the footnote about the CPT code for maggot therapy, which I don't know if this is just, I'm a doctor. It made me laugh out loud. And then I had to text one of my friends and say, hey, did you know the CPT code for maggot therapy? So I appreciated that.
I just love that there's a Medicare reimbursement code for maggots. And the fact that they're approved, the FDA approved maggots as a medical device. And I'm like, this is what I live for, these little facts. So I'm glad that you enjoyed that.
I'll ask Sydney what CPT stands for after the show. You strike me as somebody who has sort of like a boundless curiosity about pretty much everything. And the military is an organization that I think has a reputation for being somewhat secretive from time to time. Did you find yourself like frustrated by any doors that were closed to you, that wouldn't normally be in another topic?
I was surprised at how few doors were closed to me. If something was classified, the door was closed. There was no argument or debate. But anything that wasn't classified, for the most part, people in the military public affairs, although they thought some of them were very weird requests and they didn't really know who to go to get approval, they were willing to try and they were helpful. And these were people who I was like, look, you know, I could send you a copy of my book. I want you to know what I'm doing. I don't want people to feel like, oh, we thought this was a textbook you were working on, and by God, it's some weird, tasteless, stupid, trashy pop science. So I would send them. I would try to set, you know, especially if it was a big request. Like I want to go out on a submarine, out for a few days somehow, which is not an easy thing to have happen, because some sections of it are classified. I mean, nobody knows where it is, and there's not a lot of space on a nuclear sub. And so, you know, I knew that it was going to be a challenge. So I right up front sent them copies of Packing for Mars. And I was like, okay, see what I did for astronauts? I want to do that for soldiers. Can you help me? And they got it, and they were really helpful. And I had anticipated the opposite for the reasons that you mentioned. I had imagined the military to be very secretive, and they are, of course, secretive if it's something that's going to compromise their service members, you know, like, sure. Like here's something, camouflage, that work is classified, the print on your fabric, that for whatever reason, that's some information that they don't want shared. So sometimes it was kind of a surprise to learn that something was classified, and other things were just, it made perfect sense that the answer was no. Like at one point I wanted to go out with the special operations, you know, the guys who do the high risk missions.
Sure.
They have a weather arm. So there's because the weather, and you wouldn't really think about this, but the weather can make or break one of these missions. And so they have weathermen, and I wanted to profile, because I thought, God, you make it to special operations, you're like the cream of the crop, you're like the guy, like the virile, omnipotent special ops guy. And then people go like, oh, so special ops, what do you do? And they're like, weather. So I thought, I really wanted to profile that. And I called up Special Operations Command Public Affairs and I explained all this. And he's like, Mary, these are classified missions. Like, did you know? And I was like, yeah, but I'll only talk about the weather. I won't talk about anything else that they're doing.
I don't know how to keep a secret, pal.
Yeah, he's like, this is so not going to happen.
They're literally doing the thing that they have to make the secret about. Like, they're making the secrets happen. As shocked as Sydney is when I don't know a topic, she is perhaps even more shocked when I get yucked out by anything. Because she does not, nothing seems to faze her except the only thing
that I've ever found that bothers me that is for some reason, like spit, especially if somebody wants to like hawk a big loogie and bring it to me to show it to me, because that happens a lot. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think most physicians get people bringing them loogies and say, hey, look at this. Is this a normal one?
I'm with you.
That's the only thing that ever kind of I get a little bit of a gag reflex with, but everything else is pretty cool.
Do you have a thing? Does Mary, can Mary
Yeah, Rush you know what it
out?
Is? What is yeah, it? You know what it is? It's specifically, okay, I have a saliva chapter in Gulp, and there's two kinds of saliva, as you know, stimulated and unstimulated. And the unstimulated is that like ropey, mucousy, not clear and watery, really disgusting. And that grosses me out. I'm with you.
There we go.
Because the researcher and I, we collected, you can collect stimulated or unstimulated saliva, and we did that, and I was just like, ah, oh. And she's going, look how the mucin strands, if I pull this away quickly, the mucin strands stretch away, it's remarkable. I'm like, ah! It's like when your okra isn't prepared right, and you pick up your spoon from the bowl, and there's that strand, like the silver cord. Ah, I can't even eat my gumbo.
Oh, now you've ruined okra for me.
Ew, yeah. I don't order it anymore because it happens all the time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm glad I'm in good company then. Yeah.
That's true.
Mary Roach, when will people be able to buy Grunt for themselves?
The release date is June 7, but you can pre-order it right now.
All right. Go do that. Mary Roach, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Great.
Thank you so much to Mary Roach for joining us, and thank you to you, Sydney, because without you, there would be no Sawbones, and without Sawbones, I wouldn't have gotten to talk to Mary Roach.
Well, thank you, Justin, because this you have made a dream come true for me.
Well, Mary Roach made a dream come true for you, babe. I just sent the emails. but I'm certainly happy we can work it out.
I'll give you a little. I would have been too nervous to email her myself, so okay. I will give you that credit.
So thank you to Mary Roach for talking with us.
Go check out her books, seriously. Stiff books. And Spook and Gulp and Bonk. They have great names too,
yeah,
right?
Fun to say. So fun to say that's hard to read.
I've read them. They're wonderful. Read them.
Let's see. What? Oh, that's right. We're doing a live show in Boston with my brother and me on July 16th at the Wilbur Theater. If you want tickets, you can go to bit.ly/ MBMBAM Boston is what it is. And you can go there and get tickets. They are $25, I believe, right around there, around 25.
We'll have more information as it gets closer.
No, because they go on sale Wednesday at noon. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, that's today at noon.
Well, then we
EST.
Won't.
We won't have more information, but it's available for you on the website.
I'm sure we'll be tweeting.
/MBMBAM Boston. So you can go get tickets to that and see us with my brother and me. It's at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're really looking forward to it. We're going to be in New York and D.C. this weekend, but the tickets to those shows are sold out. So,
don't you go buying them from scalpers now.
Don't buy them from scalpers.
We don't like that noise.
No scalping on our watch. Thanks to the taxpayers for letting us use your song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. Thanks to Maximum Fun Network for letting us host our show here and be part of their family, their podcast family. And I think that's going to do it for us. Until the next time we have a show for you. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
As always, don't drill a hole in your head.
All right. Yeah. MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.